I-17.
Every week, 78-year-old Milton Jones calls bingo at his local senior center in Pittsburgh.
G-51.
For 31 years, Milton worked in Pittsburgh steel mills.
From 18 years old, I worked in the open hearth, and when we made the steel, and I worked in a lower level where we poured the steel.
Now, like most folks over the age of 65, Milton depends on Medicare. And like most Medicare beneficiaries, he believes he's simply getting what he paid for.
Do I feel like I earned it? I imagine so. I paid taxes all my life.
From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. And our cover story today, Medicare's math problem. Now, the word entitlement, at least in a legal sense, means something very simple. It means a right granted to you. That's Medicare. In Washington speak, it's called an entitlement program, meaning that you and me and every single American is entitled to receive guaranteed health care once we turn 65. It's our right. And most of us believe it's simply a return on a lifetime of paying for it from our weekly or monthly paychecks. That's basically what the government has led us to believe.
I paid taxes all my life.
But the numbers just don't add up. A few chairs away from Milton Jones in that same Pittsburgh Senior Center, 70-year-old John Fury is also playing bingo. For 30 years, he delivered the mail, maybe even yours.
I walked about 7 miles a day, about 1,200 steps every day.
And every week, like every single other American, a modest chunk of his wages was taken out. The Medicare tax.
It was on my pay receipt.
He's a Medicare beneficiary now, and like Milton, he told us he'd paid up over his career.
That's a good bingo.
Same with Diane Rosolowski. She's a retired librarian from Seattle.
Oh, yes. Well, I had been paying into the Medicare system since 1966.
Every paycheck of her life.
That's exactly it.
And for part of her career, she worked at her husband's veterinary clinic.
And when I was paying people, when my husband had his own practice, they would say, "What's that? What's that?" And I'd say, "That's your prepaid medical care for when you are a senior citizen."
We also called up Elaine Shapiro in Brookline, Massachusetts.
I'm 86.
And for most of her life, she was covered under her husband's insurance.
But then when he died, I had cancer and it called for surgery. I didn't have to pay huge medical bills. I was taken care of by Medicare. I've always paid taxes. I think most people feel the way I do. If anyone talks about changing Medicare, we get very nervous.
And some people get more than nervous.
Ours is 35%. Hey, come on, everybody.
You are hearing angry voices here.
You're a liar!
Sounds from a recent town hall meeting in Wisconsin hosted by Congressman Paul Ryan.
If you're yelling, I just want to ask you to leave.
Paul Ryan's the architect of a Republican plan to fundamentally change the way health care for seniors is paid for. His idea would essentially phase Medicare out. In its place, the government would give each person over the age of 65 a voucher worth a certain amount of money that you could then use to buy private health insurance.
The price controls in Medicare today are causing doctors to stop seeing patients, and Medicare is the biggest contributor to skyrocketing health care costs.
The argument Paul Ryan and President Obama both make is that Medicare basically hands a blank check to hospitals and doctors. And critics of Medicare say that system actually encourages wasteful and unnecessary tests and procedures that cost billions of dollars. President Obama argues the government can rein in costs by curbing what it's willing to pay for. Elective surgery, for example. And Paul Ryan says his plan will do the same thing, except put it in the hands of the private sector. Now, whatever you think about either of these ideas, most economists agree on this. Neither will solve Medicare's long-term funding problem, because almost nobody in America, including those seniors we just heard from, has paid for the Medicare benefits they'll receive.
An average couple retiring today has paid just a little over $100,000. In Medicare taxes, and they'll get about $300,000 in benefits.
That's Eugene Sterley. He's a former Treasury Department official, and he decided to look at all the Medicare taxes Americans have paid over the past 50 years. And he found out that the vast majority of people on Medicare today put in less than half of what they'll receive. And he's adjusted for inflation and factored in both employer and employee taxes. And he's not just picking on older folks. For a guy like me, I make out even better. By the time I'm eligible for Medicare in 2039, If the government continues to borrow cash and run massive debts, I'll get about four times the value in benefits than I paid in taxes. So how did we get to the point today where Medicare taxes don't even begin to cover health care costs for seniors? Here's Eugene Sterley.
Well, the way we designed health insurance when health costs were very low is that when you and I went to the doctor, we bargained over what everybody else would pay. So you're the doctor, I'm the patient. We decided need additional MRI. Okay, we send the bill to the taxpayers. You and I decide we need an expensive knee surgery. We send the bill to the taxpayers.
Hip replacement.
Right. And so the incentive for me as a consumer to worry about the cost isn't very high.
There's no incentive.
For the most part. There are some, over time there have been gradual increases in copayments, but not very much. But the incentive for providers is also a little strange too, because the providers have this incentive to keep listing as many services as possible, because the more services the hospital can list, the more they can collect.
Why is it that healthcare costs have risen so dramatically, especially in comparison with inflation?
There are actually three factors involved. We have more and more beneficiaries relative to workers paying into a system. That's driving up the cost of the system and the taxes we have to collect to pay for it. A second one is that we have more and more years of benefits. We're living longer. That's a modest factor over any short period of time, but over decades, it starts adding up quite a bit. The biggest factor in health, which extends far beyond any other system, is that no one really is in charge of saying no to the prices and the services that we're going to receive. And so this medical cost inflation, as it's sometimes described, is out of control under the current system.
So Medicare taxes that people pay, that we all pay out of our paychecks every week or 2 weeks or month, however we're paid, that covers what percentage of Medicare costs?
The Medicare tax per se covers about a third.
A third.
And the premiums the elderly pay maybe cover another sixth.
So the shortfall is made up from other sources of revenue.
Money, right.
Money that you could argue could be spent on education or infrastructure or other things.
Well, not just other sources of revenues today. It's also borrowing from China and Germany and a lot of other countries.
So essentially when people say, it's my money, I paid my whole life in payroll taxes, that is a myth. They have been lied to or they have been led to believe something that is just not true.
What they paid for is their parents. They paid for their parents' health care.
I mean,
and if their parents' health care was relatively cheap, that was a good thing. The question then arises, how much can they demand from their children because they paid for their parents? Let's take a simple case. Suppose you have a household with three children and they cover their parents' health costs, and the health costs are low. And now the next generation comes along and they only have two children and they say, well, I paid for my parents, you should pay for me. But now there's fewer children around to pay for it. And in fact, my health costs are a lot higher. So to what extent does that mean that I am entitled from my children to have all my health costs covered?
What you're describing to me sounds, in another context, like a pyramid scheme.
I'm reluctant to use that term, in part because it is possible to have one generation pay for the previous generation and then the next generation to pay for the current one. I mean, in some sense, before we had our elderly programs, that's what we did often as families, right? The question is not whether you want to have a system where children help support their parents, even through a tax system. The question is whether the level of benefits that we're requiring each generation to pay makes sense.
Eugene Sterley, let me just bring in your colleague who worked with you on this research, Stephanie Renan, who is a research associate at the Urban Institute. Stephanie, I don't want you to contradict your boss here, but I know that you did a lot of this research as well. How old are you, by the way?
25.
25. Do you believe that you will receive Medicare?
Well, you know, I mean, when you sit around and if I talk to my friends, other people who are 25 right now, they say, forget it, it's not going to be around for us. I think the system probably will be retained in some way, probably won't look like what it does today.
Were you surprised to see how little, in comparison to what you receive, how little people pay in taxes over the course of their careers and then what they actually receive? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it surprised me initially. I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense, but it's not what you kind of assume when you think about the system, you know, from an outside perspective.
Eugene Sterley, let me ask you this. A lot of people who listen to this program are beneficiaries, Medicare beneficiaries. So forgive me if this is going to anger you, but I want to ask, Eugene, I want to ask you this question. In order to make this system solvent, will people currently on Medicare and people about to receive Medicare, will they have to also make sacrifices?
I don't see any way we can exempt any broad portion of the population from tackling our broad budget issues.
And when you say tackling those issues, you're talking about?
I'm talking about everything. I'm talking about higher taxes. I'm talking about possible cuts. But let me be clear, and this is very misleading. When we're talking about cuts in things like health care and even elderly support programs, we're basically talking about cuts in a rate of growth. So if healthcare is going to grow by $100 billion next year and we only let it grow by $80 billion, we don't say that's an increase of $80 billion. We define that as a $20 billion cut. Mm. What we have to do to get this budget under control is to bring health costs and to some extent retirement programs down to a rate of growth that's sustainable. But it doesn't mean, for instance, that your children aren't going to get more healthcare in the future. They are, partly because we're going to invent a lot better things to provide them. It just means the rate of growth that we now promise is totally unsustainable.
That's Eugene Sterley. He's a former Treasury Department official and now a fellow at the Urban Institute. You can find all of his research at the website urban.org. Eugene Sterley, thanks so much.
Jordy, very much. Thank you.
And Stephanie Renan, thank you.
Thanks.
With every passing day, the NBA tea leaves suggest that at least there will be at least one more season for the Sacramento Kings. Earlier this month, the only major professional sports team the city has ever known looked as good as gone. But as Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports, many credit the full court press led by the mayor and former basketball star Kevin Johnson.
2 weeks ago, it looked certain that this would be Sacramento's final memory of its beloved NBA team. The Kings' 26th season in town had just ended with a gut-wrenching overtime loss to the rival Los Angeles Lakers, the team Sacramento can never seem to beat when it matters most. And thousands of fans simply wouldn't leave. They chanted, "Here we stay." At that point, it didn't appear the team's owners had any intention of staying. The Maloof family was deep in negotiations to move the Kings south to Anaheim. NBA owners would meet the next day to discuss the team's future, and fans like Ken Miller had just about given up.
I think they're going to hope for a miracle.
But the next day, Sacramento saw a glimmer of hope.
We get a chance today to build a case for why it makes sense to stay in Sacramento.
Mayor Kevin Johnson flew to New York to address NBA officials. He arrived with a couple of aces up his sleeve, millions in new season ticket and luxury suite commitments from local businesses, and billionaire grocery magnate Ron Burkle, who's ready to buy the Kings and keep them in Sacramento. As an all-star point guard in the 1990s, Johnson led the Phoenix Suns to the NBA Finals. Now, the mayor was fighting for the town where he grew up.
It's funny that as an NBA player, I've got dressed for many games and you're always excited, and I played essentially 12 years for one NBA team. But this morning, the first time I got dressed, and I felt like I was playing for the Sacramento Kings.
Johnson has always been a fierce competitor in the basketball arena and the political arena. He's also a polarizing figure at City Hall. Critics have consistently faulted him for being long on style but short on substance. After Sacramento's years of failed attempts at building a replacement for aging Arco Arena, NBA Commissioner David Stern demanded substance. He announced a fact-finding effort
to determine whether certain of the representations that were made by the mayor of Sacramento can be reduced to certainty.
Stern sent league executives to Sacramento to verify the business support the mayor promised. And earlier this week, Johnson delivered. More than 30 businesses handed checks to the NBA.
The league has said to Sacramento, show me the money. And today we're doing just that. We're making a down payment on the future for the Kings. That's our commitment.
On the first day of the NBA's fact-finding visit, Sacramento went purple. Fans across town wore Kings colors, and buildings were bathed in purple light. Bars got in on the act, too.
And here it comes, brilliantly purple ice cream.
Yeah, we're not real sure on the flavor. You know, I'm not sure what kind of flavor purple is.
Chris Garcia was trying some suspicious-looking ice cream along with his drink at Three Fires Lounge. He said he hadn't followed local politics much, but he's impressed with Mayor Johnson's efforts.
If the Kings end up not staying, it won't be because of his lack of trying at this point. If they do stay here, I think that legacy is going to pay dividends for him locally and beyond. for years to come.
The Kings owners have until Monday to decide whether to file a relocation request with the league. Yet even if they stay next season, the team's long-term future remains uncertain. Commissioner Stern says Sacramento won't be a viable NBA market without a new arena. Voters have rejected arena taxes before, and this is very likely the city's last shot. For NPR News, I'm Ben Adler in Sacramento.
In Zanesville is a new book by Joanne Beard. It's about being in the ninth grade in Zanesville, Illinois, about a girl whose dad drinks, whose mother is hanging on by a thread, about the lives of two best friends in this middle-sized mid-American place, a place where crazy neighbors are treasured because they're not like everybody else. Joanne Beard joins us from our New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you say early on in the book, you have a section on what your heroine says about Zanesville. She says it's the farm implement capital of the world, but that she and her best friend Felicia don't care about that. Could you just read that for us?
Sure. We live in a factory town, Zanesville, Illinois, the farm implement capital of the world. This means nothing to Felicia and me. We care only about our own neighborhood, everything between our two houses, a handful of potholed streets and alleys lined with two-story homes and one-car garages. We have a couple of busy intersections with four-way stop signs, a red brick barber shop, a corner tavern, a taxidermist, a family who paved their backyard and painted it green, and a house where the garage has been turned into a tap dance studio. Otherwise, it's all the same, every block, through our neighborhood and the neighborhoods beyond.
Joanne Beard, the girl who says that in your book, the narrator of your book, I don't know her name. What's her name?
I don't know her name either. She didn't tell me.
So why did you decide not to give her a name?
I felt so close inside her head that it didn't really occur to me to name her all the way through, because I felt in some way that I was her. And so when the moment came that somebody asked me why she didn't have a name, I just trusted my instinct and I withheld it.
So you decided to write about this girl in the middle of her teenage years. Why did you do that? Why this time of life, the early teenage years? I mean, I think for most people, this is pretty much a painful memory, with the possible exception, of course, of cheerleaders. For them, the pain comes later in most American literature.
You sound like you hope so. You know, why did I decide to do it? I'm not sure. Somebody asked me if I would be interested in writing for a younger age group, and I automatically said no. But then the idea sort of took hold inside me, and I started remembering specific incidents from my own childhood and young adulthood and getting interested in how I could twist them and expand them and portray them on a page. And I got really excited about writing in a way that I hadn't for a long time. And so I just immersed myself in it, and it was really, really fun.
She says at one point that she misses her childhood, which she describes as one long trance state broken only by bouts of sickening family discord.
Right, right. Well, she may not remember much of what happened before she was 12, but I have a pretty good memory about everything that happened to me when I was really young. And I'm not sure why that is, except that, like the narrator in this book, I was an observer. I was a person who felt slightly sidelined. I enjoyed being slightly sidelined, I think, because it gave me the opportunity to just observe the world.
I'm speaking with author Joanne Beard about her new book, In Zanesville. You did two things that I think are really remarkable. You nailed what it's like to be in school at this age, and your book is very funny without ridiculing the kids.
Well, thank you for noticing that. I don't know how funny it is. For me as the writer, I didn't find it to be that amusing, but it's true that when I go back and I look at certain sections of it now, they do make me laugh. The girls actually make me laugh. Because there's such a strange combination of earnestness and foolishness that I now find them very endearing now that I don't have to spend every day for 5 years with them.
Well, now our heroine and her friend Felicia, who she calls Flea, they cope with some truly horrific babysitting scenes with boys, with beer, with what to wear, with one particular wonderful scene where they ditch marching band in the middle of a parade, which I thought was really quite wonderful.
Right.
But then where they finally come a cropper, the thing that they run into that they just can't handle is what happens to every teenage girl, the cool kids.
They get discovered by the cheerleaders quite by accident. They would definitely not be on the radar of any of the popular kids, except that a new girl, Patty Michaels, gets transferred from another school, and she becomes a cheerleader and doesn't realize that the two girls are not popular. So she has a birthday party, and she spontaneously invites them, which throws him into quite a tailspin, because even though Patty doesn't understand that they don't belong at that party, they understand that. And so they're frantically nervous about going to the party and frantically nervous while at the party.
And that, it seems to me, I mean, it's the cool kids that cause the most pain for the other kids in high school, the followers. It's extraordinary, it seems to me, how big a problem that can be in young lives.
Well, you know, it's interesting in this book because I felt exactly that way when I introduced them to Patty Michaels and the other cheerleaders. But then I had to live with them for a while, and I had to force myself to see them all three-dimensionally, of course, which is what a writer has to do. And what I discovered about them is that each one of those, quote, popular kids has their own particular issues. And I actually became quite fond of them in all of their obnoxiousness. And I say that while admitting that the two main characters in the book also have their version of obnoxiousness as well.
My sense is that you think that what's-her-name will leave Zanesville, but that somehow Zanesville, which seems to, I guess, Zanesville sort of stands for regular and ordinary.
Right.
Zanesville
right.
will launch her in some pretty good way.
Yes, I think that What's-Her-Name will leave Zanesville, but I suspect that Zanesville will never leave What's-Her-Name.
Joanne Beard's new book is called In Zanesville. Thank you very much for talking to us about the book.
Thank you, Linda. It was great to be here.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News, directed by Elaine Heinzman and produced by Sarah Lucy Oliver, Ned Wharton, Kimberly Adams, Leah Scarpelli, Justin O'Neill, Amy Held, Claudine Ebade, Lauren Magaki, Tenbeat Ermias, and Becky Paris. Tony Marcano edits. Our technical director is Burke Hun. Kevin Waite drove the show beautifully today. Our librarian is Kim Maleski. Melissa Goh is our producer. Our show was produced today by Catherine Fox and edited by Jeffrey Bennett. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Scott Simon is back next week.
When soldiers across Europe boarded trains to join the fighting in 1914 at the start of the First World War, they were optimistic that the fight would last just a few weeks, maybe months at most.
Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany told his troops, "You will be home before the leaves fall from the trees."
That's the voice of Adam Hochschild. Almost no one believed the war would last 5 years and leave 16 million people dead. Hochschild's written a new history of the war. It's told through the stories of divided families where you had war resisters and war heroes, all from the same household. The book's called To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion. And I asked Hochschild what made the war seem so glorious at the beginning.
I think people didn't have a sense of what war would mean because for almost all of the European nations fighting, their previous experience of warfare in the previous couple of decades had been mostly of colonial wars against very poorly armed foes in Africa and Asia. For example, all of the major European countries had had machine guns for years, but they had always thought of these as weapons to be used against unruly or rebellious natives in Africa or Asia. And it had never occurred to them that the machine gun might be used in a war in Europe by the other side against them. So both sides sent huge numbers of cavalrymen into battle. And you can imagine how useless cavalry is in the age of the machine gun.
Adam Hochschild, you set your book and the primary narrative in Britain. Why did you choose Britain to tell the story of the First World War?
Well, when people write military history, it's almost always written about as a struggle between two sides in the First World War, the Allies versus the Central Powers. I was more interested in writing about this war as a struggle between people who considered it a noble and necessary crusade and people who considered it absolute madness and who refused to fight. And there were war resistors in all of the principal warring countries. For various reasons, there were more of them in England than anywhere else. And they were an extraordinary group of people. They kept diaries, they wrote letters, they published clandestine prison newspapers, and they had interesting relationships with friends and family members who were at the front fighting.
And, of course, those differences often split families. You write about a brother and a sister, John French and his sister Charlotte Despard. Can you tell me about them?
This was a spectacularly divided family, a brother who was commander-in-chief of the British forces in France and Belgium for the first year and a half of the war, his sister, an ardent anti-war activist, and moreover, brother and sister remained quite close to each other until after the war, he became Viceroy of Ireland, charged with suppressing the IRA struggle for independence against the British. She went to Ireland to work for the IRA, and they stopped speaking at that point. So that was one relationship I tried to follow, and then I looked for other divided families, and I found several.
How were anti-war activists in Britain during the First World War treated? I mean, were they imprisoned? Were they, I mean, presumably they were seen as traitors by the majority of people in the country.
They were, and they were very much scorned by the public. And they, to me, were an extraordinary group of people. One of them, for example, Fenner Brockway, had been a newspaper editor before the war. During the war, in jail, he continued to publish a newspaper clandestinely for his fellow resistors on toilet paper.
I'm speaking with the author Adam Hochschild. His new book about World War I is called To End All Wars. The vast majority of the British public were enthusiastic backers of the war. And you write about a group of English writers who would write sort of triumphantly about the war, including Rudyard Kipling. How did he and his group see the war?
Well, the great majority of British writers, like the great majority of everybody else, thought this was a noble and necessary crusade. And there was actually a meeting called by the government propaganda authorities at the beginning of the war in which they enlisted most of the country's leading writers to write propaganda, write novels that would back the war effort, and a great many of them did. Kipling had always been a big backer of the British Empire and of all things military. And he had a personal tragedy, though, during the war. He had long encouraged his son, John, who was a teenager when the war began, in a military career. John Kipling had inherited his father's bad eyesight. You know, when we see pictures of Rudyard Kipling, he's always got those thick glasses,
right,
like Coke bottle bottoms. And so John kept failing the army entrance exam. Kipling pulled strings with a field marshal who was a friend of his, and John very proudly went off to France
And in the Battle of Loos in the fall of 1915, he went into action and was never seen again. And his father was, of course, devastated, but didn't turn against the war as a result. But very poignantly was just so heartbroken by this, he even arranged with the Royal Flying Corps to drop leaflets over the German lines with descriptions of John Kipling and asking people to get in touch if they had seen his body or knew anything about him. But his body was never found.
This was a war in which a disproportionate amount of upper-class Britons died. I mean, these are Oxbridge-educated. I think, I can't remember the statistic, but some staggering number of graduates from Oxford from the year the war began, almost a third or something like that, right, died.
That's right. It was very much the thing for, you know, an upper-class boy from a famous private school or university like Oxford or Cambridge to go into the army and go into the infantry. Of men who graduated from Oxford in 1913, 31% were killed. Mm. Of boys who graduated from Eton, the leading private school in Britain, there were more than 30 Eton graduates killed in a single day, the first day of the Battle of the Somme in 1916.
Is the First World War still present?
I think it very much is, because the First World War in so many ways shaped the 20th century and really remade our world for the worse. It introduced industrialized warfare and casualties on a massive scale that the world had not seen before. In France, for example, of all men who were between the ages of 20 and 32 at the start of the war, one half were dead when it was over. And many of the remainder were horribly wounded, you know, missing hands, arms, legs, genitals. It was a wounded nation that was left.
That's the author Adam Hochschild. His new book about World War I is called To End All Wars. Adam Hochschild, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
The music that accompanied Kate Middleton as she walked down the aisle at Westminster Abbey yesterday, the royal wedding served as a public viewing of traditional pomp and cutting-edge Brit style. From Kate Middleton's classic wedding dress to amazing headgear, hats that ranged from the refined to the ridiculous. Who better to consult on matters of glamour and pageantry than Simon Doonan, the creative ambassador for Barney's New York and a columnist for Slate.com. He joins us from Shelter Island in New York, where he's presumably recovering from wedding week. Simon Doonan, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here.
Let's begin with the wedding dress, which is the subject of so much speculation. It was designed by Sarah Burton, who is now the creative director of Alexander McQueen. Silk overlaid with intricate Chantilly lace, V-shaped neckline, an 8-foot train. It was a very classic, modest look. What's your take?
Well, I'm glad you used the M word there. I mean, I was struck by the modesty of the dress. I thought it was really gorgeous, appropriate, beautiful. But what you have to realize is that there's a whole generation who's grown up seeing nothing but sort of people with fake breasts and porno chic and stripper poles and cheesy reality show, never had a Jackie O or an Audrey Hepburn or a Grace Kelly. And this is like a role model for a bunch of gals that have never had that sort of model of modesty and restraint combined with glamour and excitement and elegance. So it's you know, I once had a conversation with a guy who designed a lot of the royal attire, and he said to me, the royal family can never be chic because chic is very unkind. There's an unkindness and a coldness to chic.
Which brings me to Queen Elizabeth. In yellow, which the palace called Primrose, what did you think of that outfit?
Well, I'm not a big monarchist, but I do love the Queen. She inhabits that role that she plays perfectly. She's a public servant. She's not some bizarre Marie Antoinette figure that's indulging herself. So the Queen's approachable frumpiness is an important part of her shtick. And I got that really from the horse's mouth, from this guy, Sir Hardy Ames, who used to design her outfits.
Right, of
and
course,
he
yes.
told me Her Majesty can never be chic. She must be friendly and approachable.
I guess Hardy Ames was the inventor of the whole dyed to match thing. The dress and the coat and the hat that match.
Yes. I find it very charming. I mean, I'm a fashion person. I work in the world of fashion. But I wouldn't want everybody to be high fashion. And I think the Queen's, you know, dressing basically like an oven mitt, I find it very endearing and very charming. I was born the year of the coronation. And I represent, I think, a lot of the British people who maybe could care less about the rest of the monarchy, but they do love the Queen, or at least they respect her.
I was searching for a way to talk about dishing the hats, but so many of those hats did look like dishes, like satellite dishes, like very strange architectural phenoms, like the hats worn by the princesses Beatrice and Eugenie of York, the daughters of the infamous Fergie. They were wearing those peculiar-looking hats that appeared to have been nailed to their foreheads.
I was very entertained by the fact that they were sitting directly behind the Queen. So one got sort of endless views of them in their extraordinary hats. I think that's part of the British upper-class scene, dating back to Ascot and probably before. The outlandish hat has a place, which is kind of something to celebrate, I think, because in general, upper-class traditions tend to be stuffy. They tend to be restrained. They tend to be conservative. So this is the one area where the aristocratic women of Britain allow themselves this extra piece of flamboyance.
What were your favorite moments in the wedding?
I think seeing Kate Middleton arrive in the church and her husband look at her and say, "You look beautiful." You would have to be made of Teflon not to be touched by that, especially as they look so archetypal. You know, I keep thinking, if Kate Middleton was sort of 4'10" and enjoyed eating pasta, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. You know, they're both glamorous looking people, tall, statuesque, they have a lot of presence. So that's why we've been able to project so many romantic fantasies onto them.
Simon Doonan, creative ambassador for Barney's New York and a columnist for Slate.com. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.